coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
If someone gets your goat, could that mean they're leading you to yoga class?
We are hosting goats and yoga at the same time. It should be quite a spectacle.
And beer.
And beer.
Then, she's one of the region's most prolific authors, at least as far as her publishing schedule goes.
You know, when it rains, it pours, right? So you have a long dry spell, and then all of a sudden you sell 3 books.
We'll check in with Marky Price. Also, an analysis of police use of force policies and what appears to be excessive force against an unarmed black man, Jacob Blake. Those stories and more coming up next.
Issues from a superior point of view.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. To say these are trying times is an understatement, and the latest national story rocking our collective consciousness comes from right here in Wisconsin. On Sunday in Kenosha, police shot an unarmed black man, Jacob Blake, 7 times in the back. We'll have an update on the events in Kenosha, as well as an analysis of police use of deadly force later in the show. For now, though, can you take a deep breath and exhale slowly? Yoga practitioners have used those calming techniques for centuries, but recently some have added an extra element to the exercises. You heard right, that's the goat. And goat yoga, where the hoofed animals wander among and on members of a yoga class, is now a thing. Last Saturday, it came to the Earth Rider Brewery in Superior. And if goat yoga wasn't enough, a third ingredient was added with a decidedly Wisconsin flavor. Beer. Earth Rider founder Tim Nelson explains how the idea came about.
We are hosting goats and yoga at the same time. It should be quite a spectacle.
And beer.
And beer. Yeah, we're really excited about this new aspect of beer drinking. We're always looking for a new pastime to do while we sip our suds.
So how did this idea come about?
You know, we have a great booking manager, Tom Fabchance, that reached out to the goat yoga people and invited them. We have a really amazing yard between our brewery structure and our tap room. It's a whole half a city block, actually, that's a green space. So the goats have a place to graze and rest before and after the yoga sessions, and for the yoga participants to stretch.
They're doing a very good job in their mobile pen.
Yeah, we need them here more often. They're doing a really amazing job on our lawn upkeep. They're trimming it right down. Moving the pin might be necessary. They're making quick work of that little area for sure. Must be really tasty grass.
So had you ever heard of goat yoga before?
I hadn't. No, this is a first for me. Yeah, I had not heard of it. I've heard of yoga, of course. I've heard of goats, but not the two combined.
And your first reaction?
It sounds like fun. Sounds like something I would probably like to sit in the corner and drink beer and watch.
Nelson had no trouble supplying the beer, and Connie Larson of Duluth provided the yoga instruction.
One thing I want to start by saying is that this is not your typical yoga class. It's totally fine to take pictures. It's totally fine to just sit down and hug a baby goat. If you want a goat climbing on your back, you know, there'll be people coming around. They can put a goat on you. Some of the goats will do it on their own. There's one of the bigger ones that loves to climb. If they're too heavy or you don't want them by you, you can just give them a gentle shove. You don't want to push them, but just, you know, a little gentle shove to move them away. You do have food. They love food. You can sprinkle it on the ground or feed them from your hand. And for the yoga part, just do what you can do. Don't worry about what anyone else is doing. Just go to your own level. You know, you don't want to get hurt. It is a little bit chilly out here, so your muscles might not be super warm. You know, just take it easy. And again, if you don't want to do yoga and you want to just sit and play with the goats, that's fine. So how many people are here for the yoga today? a few. How many people are here for the beer? Oh, okay. Yeah, people like beer. How many people are here for the goats? All right. Everybody loves the goats. So what we're going to do is release the goats, and they will be wandering around. You can, again, pay attention to them, pay attention to me. Here come the baby goats. So there's five little babies that are just a few months old. There's some bigger goats, and then there's some teenagers. So enjoy the class. Thanks for coming.
Angie Abernathy, who lives off the grid with her family and furry menagerie in rural Minnesota, brought the goats.
They're all mini goats, yep. But yeah, the littler ones are baby.
These are Nigerian?
These are miniature Nigerian dwarf goats, okay. Yeah. I brought my daughters to a farm for their birthday and got to bottle feed a goat, and it was just over since then. It's like, I have to get goats. What started me into goat yoga is my partner and I both live off the grid, and we are into sustainable living too, and we just figured this kind of fits in our lifestyle. And I saw on a morning show that an actress was doing goat yoga, and that's the first time I heard of the goats and yoga combined, and something within me just lit up, and I've just always followed my gut instinct and said this is something I need to do.
Your goat instinct.
Yeah, my goat instinct, yeah.
So who showed up? Amy and Tim Lisdale of Superior each had their reasons. Amy for the goats and yoga.
You have yoga mats, so I take it already.
Yes, I've gone to yoga before. Yeah, just never with goats, but animals make you happy. So, what could be better than goats and yoga?
Have you looked it up and seen some of the pictures of the goats?
I have, with the goats on people's backs as they're trying to do the yoga. Yes.
And Tim for the other attraction.
Beer drinker.
Yes.
Well, you said Superior.
Olivia White of Superior had heard of the concept.
Yes, I have. Just not. I didn't know it was available here in the Twin Ports, though.
Okay. Have you done it before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
But you have a yoga mat, so you are a yoga person.
Sometimes.
Good enough to have a mat.
Yes, but more fun with the goats.
Definitely. So does Shauna Anderson of Superior.
I have heard of goat yoga, but I've never done it. And when I saw it was here, I could not pass up the opportunity. So here I am.
And what about the third part, and beer?
Oh, well, of course, that goes without saying.
That's a nice ending.
Yeah.
That's a good ending.
I mean, goats and beer. And yoga, it's like the trifecta, really.
Lay down on your back and close your eyes, and you're welcome to do that.
Jasmine Jackson of Eagle River didn't know goat yoga would be part of her day that morning. She was a star of a bachelorette party and was led into Earth Rider's grassy park wearing a face mask covering her eyes.
Yeah, and they almost broke my ankle because they didn't tell me there was a curb.
So when you took the mask off, what did you see?
I saw goats. They asked me to touch something, and I didn't know what it was, and I was scared it was a snake, and I don't like snakes.
You heard the little...
Yeah, but it still was a little weird to hear the baha and not see the baha.
Had you ever heard of goat yoga before?
Yes, I have. I actually, this was one of, because they kind of gave me some ideas. Well, not really ideas, but they told me I needed to bring workout pants and closed-toed shoes in the chance that I might be upside down. And I was like, either
you
it's...
You trust them a lot.
I do. And
I don't know why.
And I knew it was either had to do with yoga or skydiving. I was happy with either one.
I don't think there's goat skydiving.
Oh, dang it. One day, maybe.
And then lastly, of course, it says, and beer.
Yes. I'm excited for the beer.
She's here for the goat yoga. We're here for the beer.
Hey, I want to be here for the beer, too.
Imagine that there's a wave of relaxation starting down at her feet.
With everybody spread out, more than 6 feet between different groups of people, the goats did their thing, making friends, getting fed, and finding backs to climb on. But even goat yoga has a rain delay. I took the time to hear Connie Larson tell her story.
What got you into goat yoga?
I went to a class and it was so super fun because the goats are so fun, and you know, just being out in nature and with fresh air and sunshine and animals, it makes it so much fun. So I went to a class and then I went and talked to the instructor there and I said, if you need a sub, I'll be available. And now I do it like 3-4 times a month in the summer. And then I got connected with Duluth Goat Yoga and I'm going to be doing it for them too.
Well, if you want to set your mat up again, if you want to set it up under a tent just to be safe, that's your choice. But I think we'll be okay. It's just going to be a little slippery, so be very careful that you're not falling down. The goats are going to come back out again. They don't like the rain, so that's a lot of more hiding.
Very much do not.
Here come the babies.
Do you want to keep it here?
I don't want to scare them either.
One other thing too, like about your yoga mats, now that they're wet, don't roll them up and store them. When they're wet, they'll get moldy. So when you get home today, make sure you hang them out somewhere and let them dry. Oh, little guys. He's looking for his friends.
So how did it all turn out? Bride-to-be Jasmine Jackson had a blast, even if she found a goat on her back difficult to describe.
So you actually had a goat on your back?
I did have a goat on my back.
And what was that like?
Different.
Different than what?
I don't know how to really describe having a goat on your back. You just don't want to really move. You just like, I don't know.
How are you going to describe having a goat on your back?
I don't know, he was taking a picture. I didn't have a goat on my back.
I mean, you're so in the moment, you don't really feel, like, notice how it feels. You're just, like, frozen. You're like, oh, I have a goat on my back. I'm not trying to move. That's how it was for me, at least.
All right.
Amy Lisdale wasn't quite as lucky, though she and husband Tim were happy with the consolation beverages.
So did we get what we came for?
Yes, we did.
Yes, we did.
He said holding a beer. Where's your beer?
He's got my beer.
This one right here.
Did you get a goat climbing on you?
I did not.
Oh, okay. But you fed them?
I fed them.
Yep.
Maybe next
time. Cuddled with them. Next time. I would come back.
Yeah. I'd definitely come back.
How close did you get to the goats?
I fed them.
All right.
I fed them. I'm good with that. I'm good with that. Someday we'll have our own, so I'm not too worried about it.
Your own goat or your
own goats?
Kid. Boom, boom.
Oh, we'll have our own goats. We got 4 kids.
All right.
We're done with those. Just fur babies from now on.
They weren't the only ones getting attached.
Who had a goat on their back?
Oh, yeah. We did. All of us. I was going to say, I think all of them.
You totally did.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had more than once. You crawled with
it. Yeah, I did crawl with one on my back.
You crawled.
Emily Kelly Superior was ready to adopt one youngster.
Well, this one particularly really likes my hair, so I didn't want to abandon the goat.
It looks like you're taking that one home with you.
I'm thinking about it, yeah. I mean,
his name is Paco.
Yeah, I've named him Paco.
Yeah.
Oh, he's lame.
They'll tell them that they had 9 goats.
Yeah, that's, thank you.
They just forgot how to count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It happens.
So what's it actually feel like?
It's actually really relaxing. I don't know. You kind of get a massage while you're doing some yoga. So, yeah, it's fun. I don't know. It is hard to describe, but their little hooves, they don't tickle. They are very massaging. So
they are, like deep pressure.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you got an itch? I didn't know. Here we go. Okay. Yeah, see, I got you. Okay, there we go.
So what does it all mean? Well, if goat yoga and beer sounds strange, remember, there's nothing too weird in the new normal. Tim Nelson.
We are COVID friendly. We have a big space here, and people can spread out. and enjoy a nice breeze off the lake. So we feel real safe here.
And in that regard, it may just be the perfect COVID activity. A socially distanced outdoors exercise, a refreshing beverage, and an unbelievable cuteness factor.
And unpredictable, too, I think.
Oh, yes. This one's a little predictable, though. I don't know. They've been with me the whole session, so they just keep coming back.
At the Earth Rider Brewery in Superior, I'm Robin Washington. We'll be back after this.
The goats had fun, too. Oh.
Was a lonely goat herd, lay, or lay, or lay, ooh. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, or lay, or loo. Folks in a town that was quite remote herd, lay, or lay, or lay, ooh. Lusty and clear from the goat herd's throat herd, lay, or lay, or loo. Oh, oh, lady, or lee, oh, 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 lady, or lay, oh, oh, lady, or lee, oh, lady, or lee.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. My guest is Newbery Honor Book author Margie Price. And if you're saying, wait a minute, you just had Margie Price on the show, you're right, we did. In March and in a rebroadcast last month featuring her two new books from earlier this year, Village of Scoundrels and The Littlest Voyager. But she's back because she already has another book out. It's The Silver Box, the latest in her Enchantment Lake mystery series. Margie joins us from her home in Duluth, where she must not be doing anything else but writing. So welcome back to Simply Superior.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So can I attribute this to the pandemic? We've had some musicians who've been prolific composers during this time.
Absolutely not. I am one of those people that's really accomplished very, very little in the course of these months. These books, you know, people ask me that. They said, oh, you've been so busy. And, well, it's true, I have. But, well, Littlest Voyager that you just mentioned, that was a story that I had kicking around since 2003. Wait, I'm way off. I mean, you know, sometimes you write these things and you put them away.
Sure.
And you pull them out and you work on them a little bit and you put them away and so on. And actually, my agent had sent it out over the years every time I would revise it, and it kept getting rejected. And then finally somebody took it. So it's not like I have just created all of this stuff all at once, I guess you could say. And things kind of, you know, when it rains, it pours, right? So you have a long dry spell, and then all of a sudden you sell three books.
Right. Well, it's not just writing the book. I mean, book publishing is a whole complicated and involved process, right? So even if you did write it in 2003, you may not get around to publishing it for whatever reason until now.
That's really true. A lot of things depend on the publishers. And Village of Scoundrels, for instance, was supposed to come out first a whole year before it did. And then it got bumped another 6 months. And then it got bumped another 6 months. And not because of me. Mm-hmm. That was something with the publisher, that just the way they wanted the books to come out. They have their own, you know, ideas. So that sort of thing happens, too.
Mm-hmm. We don't need to hear about my literary prowess, but it is my show, so I guess I can say something about it. But actually, I'm going to say this one to make you feel better, which is I have a rule that one line is a line, two lines is a quote, and three lines is a poem, and it's one of my rules for poetry. So I wrote the following. Is this an alley or a country road I've walked on seeking shelter from the crowd? It's two lines, and I never got the third one. I wrote that 40 years ago. So you should feel pretty good about 2003.
That reminds me of, I saw a little thing by Billy Collins where he said, you know, the trick to writing poetry is to write one good line and then another good line and then another good line. And just keep doing that.
Easy for him to say. No, I do write complete poems. But I think in that case, I think I kind of ended it. What do you say after that? And I've been wandering for 40 years.
So, you're done.
Yeah.
So, well, it's a short poem.
All right. Well, let's move on from that and pretend we never went there. The Silver Box is part of your Enchantment Lake Mystery Series. It is number 3. You can tell us about the other two. But before we do that, it's a mystery for young readers, sort of middle school age. That's an interesting niche market.
Well, it's I guess I have been describing it as a Northwoods Nancy Drew kind of story. So when I was probably about 10, 11, you know, that's when I started getting into the Nancy Drew genre of books. And I think that's kind of my readership there, too, is upper middle grade, you know, the sort of middle school age. Mm-hmm. And why I do write for that age, I think mainly because that's the time when kids are really, their world is opening up and they're starting to see beyond their little world, home, family, school, and realizing there's a big world out there and that they're a part of it and they're going to have to, you know, go out into it, kind of like the three little pigs. Eventually they're going to have to go seek their fortune. And who are they going to be and what's going to happen to them? What kind of person are they going to become? And I think that reading fills that need to be able to have the freedom to think about different possibilities and to kind of put yourself in other people's shoes and imagine, what if I was like this? Or what if I did something like this person is doing? And would I make these choices? And would I be this brave or this stupid? Or, you know, I think we all do that when we read, but I think that kids 11, 12, 13, 14 years old are, it's very meaningful. Mm-hmm. You know, they're big questions for them.
Well, and the whole genre of mystery is all about a question, right? You're trying to solve something. So it's not just, did I make the right decision or whatever. You'll find out if you made the right decision because it's whether or not you solve the mystery.
Right, if you solve the mystery. Well, I think all stories are mysteries on some level. Mm. You know, every story offers a question, I think, that needs to be answered. Otherwise, why would we keep reading, really?
Well, we keep reading because we have a whole series here. So tell us about the first two books.
Yeah. So Enchantment Lake, the series, takes place at a mythical, fictional northern Minnesota lake that is really based on 3 of my favorite northern Minnesota lakes. So it's sort of a conglomeration of places that I think Minnesotans and Wisconsinites, of course, would really recognize. Could be in northern Wisconsin as well. But I happen to live in Minnesota, so that's where it's placed.
You're close enough.
But, you know, I think everybody recognizes the scenes of swimming, boating, berry picking, eerie noises in the bog, lost kayaks, exploding bulldozers, and poison hot dishes. So, you know, it's got it all. And murder, right? Of course.
Oh, of course. My guest is Margie Price. She's the author of, let me rephrase that, she's probably the region's most prolific author, at least when books all come out at the same time. She's author of The Peace Bell, Heart of a Samurai, which was a Newbery Honor book, Village of Scoundrels and The Littlest Voyager from this year, and now also this year, The Silver Box, the latest in her Enchantment Lake Mystery series. Tell us about the protagonist, Francie. And I see that in the first book, she actually starts out in Manhattan, which the last time I looked was not an island in either Wisconsin or Minnesota. So without giving away the great mysteries of the first two books, and certainly not the third, tell us who Francie is and where her travels take her.
Okay. Yeah, Francie is 17 years old, living in New York City and auditioning for roles in plays and musicals. And she gets a call from her great aunts who live in the summertime at their cabin on Enchantment Lake. And they start telling her that people are getting murdered and that maybe their lives are in danger. So, or at least that's the way she interprets what they're telling her. And she just gets on a plane and flies home. She's very independent, partly because both of her parents are either dead or we don't know. So that's part of the overarching mystery of the three mysteries, is what happened to her mother. Her father, we know, has died, but her mother, it's a little more mysterious. And so each story, the first one is called Enchantment Lake, and the second one is The Clue in the Trees, and this is the third, The Silver Box. Each one has its own mystery to solve that's solved in the course of the one book. And then there's the mystery that takes the three books to solve, which is what happened to Francie's mother and where is she, and can Francie reunite with her?
All right. That sounds like a perfect setup for the third book, which is
that's right.
Why and, you wrote it. Yes.
Yeah. And so Francie, at the beginning of this book, has come into possession of a box, a silver box that she believes, she knows it's sort of irrational, but she believes that somehow this box is going to lead her to her mother. And she has awakened right after having procured this box in the previous book, and it realizes what she possesses, and she's a little bit scared because she's afraid to find out. So she hasn't opened it yet. She's awake before her friends and her brother, who are at the cabin with her, and she goes outside and discovers footprints in the snow, and they're not anybody's at the cabin, and there's nobody on that side of the lake because everyone has left for the summer. And so she decides to follow the footprints. Okay. All right. So this part is in the very first chapter. It's not the very, very beginning, but it's towards the end of the first chapter. Francie is at her aunt's cabin. Her aunts aren't there, but she's there with her brother and two of her friends. It picks up right after the end of the second book, which is called The Clue in the Trees.
All right.
Glancing behind her at the cabin, she wondered if one of her friends or her brother had been out already, then gone back to sleep without bringing any wood to stoke up the fire. But the soft depressions in the snow didn't lead to the outhouse or to the woodpile or even down to the lake, as she would have expected. Instead, they led back into the woods that, as Francie knew, stretched all the way to Canada. Who could it be? All the cabins were shuttered and closed up. Not a soul to be seen. Not a dock out, all boats off the lake, and definitely no cars. There was no road on this side of the lake. She pulled Theo's jacket snug and stood for a moment staring at the lake, or where she knew the lake to be. A dark line of trees was visible along the near shore, but everything beyond dissolved into a misty whiteness. She blinked away the snowflakes on her eyelashes, turned, and started to follow the tracks. As snow settled into the footprints ahead of her, they slumped into ill-defined round circles, simple holes punched in the snow that could have been made by anything, a deer, a bear, or, she thought at nearly the same time as she saw it standing just at the edge of the forest, a wolf. He was huge and noble, with his thick coat of silver-gray fur and watchful yellow eyes, the royalty of this kingdom, the way the lion is king of the Serengeti. Or maybe, Francie thought, this wolf was the queen, and queenly she looked, literally shimmering, as if silver threads were woven into her coat. The wolf's yellow eyes flamed with something that set Francie's heart racing, something ancient and wise, yet utterly wild. In some deep place inside her, Francie felt her own wild nature flutter to life. Then the wolf shook itself, casting off a glittering shower of snow, and disappeared as if in a magician's cloud of smoke. Francie staggered back toward the cabin, the footprints forgotten, as if she'd fallen under a spell. The crack of a rifle shattered the stillness, jolting Francie straight out of her enchantment and sent her racing for the cabin.
All right. We've been listening to Margie Price reading from her latest book in the Enchantment Lake mystery series, The Silver Box, the third and final book in the series. Margie is, can I say, the undisputed heavyweight champion of the Duluth Superior book world. And her latest is the third title of hers issued this year, and we're thrilled to have her on the show.
Well, thanks. I think that might be a bit of an exaggeration.
I was trying to talk over to you to keep you from responding to that. But so it seems like a silly question with all of this material that is coming out this year to ask what's next. But what is next? Perhaps a middle school edition of War and Peace?
Oh, there's an idea.
So that's how you get them. People like me say crazy things and you go ahead and do it.
That's right. That's where I get my ideas, Robin. Actually, the next two that I know of will be picture books for young, you know, for children. So, and one is called Lily Leads the Way, and it's about a little sailboat who wants to get out into the big lake from the harbor, but she can't get the bridge to open up for her.
We've all had that problem, yes. Something yeah. we can absolutely relate to around here.
That's what I thought. It's obviously set in Duluth, or between Duluth and Superior, I guess you'd say.
Right.
So.
Great. And The Silver Box is, again, the latest and final title in the Enchantment Lake Mystery Series by Margie Price. It is scheduled for release in October. You can find out all about her work and where to order at margieprice.com. That's MargiePreuss.com.
And we are also having a virtual book launch on October 6th that Zenith Bookstore in Duluth will be hosting. I am pretty sure it's at 7 o'clock, and you'll find information on either Zena's website or mine.
Great. Margie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back after this.
The wood is full of shining eyes. The wood is full of creeping feet. The wood is full of tiny cries. You must not go to the wood at night. I met a man with eyes of glass and a finger as cruel as the wriggling worm and hair all red with rotting leaves and a stick that hissed like a summer snake. The wood is full of shining eyes, the wood is full of creeping feet, the wood is full of tiny cries, you must not go to the wood at night.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hello.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hello, Robin.
So once again, the nation has been rocked by a video of a police officer using what appears to be excessive force against an unarmed black man, Jacob Blake. And once again, it's pretty close to home, this time in Kenosha. Fortunately, this time he survived, despite being shot 7 times in the back. Danny, do we know what his condition is as of Thursday?
Well, when his family spoke earlier this week, Julia Jackson, Blake's mother, said that her son was fighting for his life and that he would likely require additional surgeries. You know, he had to have his entire colon and small intestines removed as a result of the injuries he sustained in the shooting. And it left him paralyzed. His spinal cord and vertebrae were shattered after he was shot, as you said, 7 times.
And this, of course, has sparked outrage in Kenosha and around the country.
Yes, there have been protests and rallies since Sunday when the shooting occurred. And Wednesday, they were mostly peaceful. But on Tuesday, unfortunately, 2 people were killed and 1 person was injured. And authorities have since charged Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old from Illinois, with shooting protesters during an altercation outside of a gas station in Kenosha. He had said that he was trying to protect property earlier in the evening. And in a news conference on Wednesday, the mayor of Kenosha asked people not to arm themselves. He did not want an armed militia present, and that was something that a group had put out a call on Facebook asking people to come to Kenosha to protect property. And also in the case, the Wisconsin Department of Justice released new details on Wednesday evening. The officer who shot Blake in the back 7 times was Officer Rustin Shesky. He had served with the Kenosha Police Department for 7 years, and he was the only officer to fire. And the Wisconsin Department of Justice also said Blake admitted to officers that he was in possession of a knife during the incident, and officers recovered that knife on the driver's side floorboard of Blake's vehicle. The State Division of Criminal Investigations is leading the investigation. and they're being assisted by the FBI and other agencies, and they hope to have a report about the incident to a prosecutor within the next 30 days. And on Thursday, the Reverend Jesse Jackson was in Kenosha to show support for the family of Jacob Blake and also call on the Wisconsin Department of Justice to move quickly in their investigation. Here's an excerpt of some of what Jackson had to say in Kenosha on Thursday.
Shot in the back 7 times. No, just in front of his children. No justification. When Laquan McDonald was killed in Chicago. Covered up the tape. 400 days, 16 shots. The line said he approached him with a knife. The film show he shot him in the back. Paid $5 million for cover-up, and it didn't work. So, well, Laquan McDonald, Breonna Taylor, Jacob here in Wisconsin, pattern, we demand justice from the country. There's a kind of moral desert at the top. The president had a little power, but he had aspirations for justice and decency. The day there's a moral desert, top down. Acid rain is coming, top down. When Dr. King gave the speech in Washington, in John Lewis, 1963, only one black official in the whole South, Leroy Johnson, Atlanta, Georgia. From Texas to Florida, from Maryland, we couldn't use a single public toilet. We couldn't buy a shoe with Howard Johnson. Couldn't rent a room at Holiday Inn. We lived in tyranny. Black and brown, sort of sat behind Nazi prisoner of war on American military bases. 57 years later, there's something more sinister. The case of Minnesota, Wisconsin, up south. Something is going awry.
Jackson said that the 3 officers who were involved should be in jail until Jacob Blake can walk.
Well, at least in this case, it's a little bit different than the previous incidents because Mr. Blake did survive, and obviously everybody wishes him well. Brooks, what's going on the Minnesota side of the Bay? And I'm guessing it's also related to a national story.
Yes, fresh off the Republican National Convention, Vice President Mike Pence will be in Duluth today, Friday, to speak at a Trump campaign rally at the Clure Public Marine Terminal, a sprawling warehouse and outdoor area on Duluth's harborfront. Mm-hmm. He's expected to give some remarks in front of an audience of supporters, and then he's off to Michigan to woo other swing state voters over there. The Trump campaign is certainly hopeful they can flip Minnesota red for the first time in many decades, something they came close to doing 4 years ago.
Right. Each party, of course, has a bump after their convention, so this is one day following the Republican convention. I noticed, though, he's not appearing at the deck, which is actually, I think, the last place that President Trump appeared in Duluth. We've got some interesting news coming out of there.
Yeah. So earlier this week, I found out that Shelley Townsend, the executive director of the DEC for the past 3 years, did not have her contract renewed by the board. That happened earlier this summer. And on Wednesday, the board named as interim director former state senator Roger Reinert. Now, Roger was, until very recently, a board member himself on the DEC board. That board's appointed by the governor and the mayor. To oversee this special authority, the big sprawling campus that includes Amsoil Arena. And we pressed the board for why the contract wasn't renewed for Townsend, who had been working at the DEC herself since 1990. They declined to give any reasons, citing it as a personnel matter. We are continuing to ask questions about this as the DEC enters a tumultuous time, as many entertainment venues do across the nation and the world, without any events to bring in revenue.
Right, a difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Danny, back on the Wisconsin side, a difficult time continues. I think I feel like a broken record on this, but the coronavirus just isn't going away.
Yeah, no. This week, actually, Iron County in northern Wisconsin became the county with the highest rate of new cases per capita in Wisconsin. They've seen more than 115 cases of coronavirus, and you know, it's only a county of roughly 5,600 residents. And back in July, they had fewer than 10 cases. But, you know, a lot of the recent cases have been among residents. And it looks like, according to Zona Wick, a nurse and county health spokesperson, that, you know, most of them are due to people feeling that it's their right to keep their businesses open. And in Sawyer County, they have seen more cases of COVID-19 in August than they had seen in all the months prior since the start of the pandemic. Their cases have more than doubled in the month of August in Sawyer County, and the county's health officer, Julie Lyons, actually had made a request that the school district go to all virtual classes for the first couple weeks of school, but the school board decided against that.
You know, when you mention Iron County, I have a sort of journalist memory for stories that we've reported, and I recall that our first incidence of a fatality from COVID-19 actually was in Iron County way back, as you pointed out, in the beginning of the pandemic. I will say this means nothing. It means a lot, of course, for the person who was lost. But you can't make statistical analysis based on samplings of one or even the numbers we have now. But I think it pretty clearly shows that places that are very rural are not immune.
Well, absolutely, Robin, because, you know, most of the counties that have the highest rate of new cases per capita in the last several weeks, for the most part, those have been rural counties that are outside of the urban centers.
Well, telling us again, which we all should know, you take it seriously wherever you go. Well, we've been speaking with Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. We've also been joined by my colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And now more on a Kenosha shooting. With my perspective as a journalist who's covered criminal justice issues for decades, if you've heard me talk about police training the past few years, it'll sound like I'm rehashing my same old stump speech. And for that, I beg forgiveness. But it bears repeating with increasing urgency at every use of excessive police force. I took a module on the use of force hosted by the Duluth Police Department 10 years ago. Projected on a giant screen were video characters engaged in a variety of scenarios, and participants were to decide whether to respond with a nightstick, taser, or gun, or no force at all. I decided to tase a guy with a baseball bat, only to see the electronic probes bounce off him. He then bashed my head in, and I died. Worse, I got yelled at by the sergeant administering the test. "Didn't you consider the baseball bat a deadly weapon?" he barked. Along with the imaginary bat, the rule drilled into my head was always use the next highest level of force. If the subject is unarmed, maybe use a baton. If there's a knife, then use a gun. It usually gets the gun real quick. That was, as I said, a decade ago, and since then it's changed in many departments. Now the emphasis is on escalation and de-escalation of force. If a guy has a baseball bat and you think you can talk him down by tossing some balls and turning it into batting practice, saying, "How about those twins?" then you don't shoot him. All that sounds fine, except I can't get that original training out of my head. So what makes anyone think that real officers can? In the George Floyd case, veteran officer Derek Chauvin didn't use a deadly weapon, but instead a highly questionable technique, a knee to the neck. Even more questionable, it was for nearly 8 minutes, and almost 2 minutes after Floyd appeared to stop breathing. Recently released body cam video shows rookie officer Thomas Lane began that encounter by drawing his gun seconds after tapping on Floyd's SUV window, and barely seconds after Floyd even acknowledged he was there. Lane was fresh out of the academy. Was that part of his de-escalation training? Now the world has seen a Kenosha officer shoot Jacob Blake point blank in the back 7 times. Yes, Blake appeared to ignore him and was getting into his car, maybe, in the officer's mind, to get a weapon. Is shooting him in the back part of the new de-escalation? Investigators now say Blake admitted to having a knife, which was found in the floorboards of the driver's seat of the car. For the record, his children also were in the car. In the training I took, I actually did attempt to talk down the guy with the baseball bat, and the sergeant administering the test did give me credit for trying. But he explained that the module wasn't interactive. Like I said, that training was outdated, but maybe it was a glimpse at the future. Since then, nearly everyone has seen real-life videos of real people dying before our eyes, causing viewers to shout, "No, don't kill them!" And like in my video, no one on the screen can hear you screaming. Finally today, a story of overcoming violence and addiction. NPR's StoryCorps team and the Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation have teamed up to bring stories of pairs of people in our area who have touched each other's lives. Here, Dustin talks with his wife, Caroline, about his path to change, meeting each other, and finding momentum to succeed in life. He credits sobriety, earning a GED, and witnessing the love they share for their children. Here's Dustin.
My mother and father were alcoholics, and when I was 13 months old, they abandoned me and my brother in a house, and they never came back for us. Eventually, my great aunt, Diz, that was her nickname, everyone called her Diz, she took me and my brothers into her home, and she raised us. Diz had grown up in boarding schools, and she was not treated very kindly as a child either. She had a discipline mechanism that involved a little bit of violence and aggression, and that was something we had experienced our whole life. And one day, she had gotten aggressive with my oldest brother, and he left, and he didn't come back. And it was just me and my little brother, Ryan, and one day he had done something wrong, and she was going to punish him, and I stepped in front of her and said, "I'm not going to let you do that to us anymore." And I took Ryan, and I left.
Where did you go?
We jumped around from foster home to foster home for a long time. Nobody cared about us. It didn't matter if we were there or not. This is when I remember my mom coming back into my life, and she didn't bring very good things with her. I started getting into drugs and alcohol. She wanted to bond with me, and that was the only thing that she knew.
Yeah. When was the moment you knew you had to make a change and become sober?
There were lots of moments when I thought, this needs to change. But when you're surrounded by people who are doing the same thing, where do you go? Who do you talk to if it's all you know?
Yeah.
The most defining moment where I devoted my will to changing was when I learned of my son being born. I said, "I'm going to be different now." And I failed. And I tried again and I failed. And the third time that I tried, I went to a different treatment center where I didn't know anybody. And I completely changed everything about myself, down to the way that I spoke, to the way that I dressed, to the way that I thought.
How did we meet?
Well, I was in a halfway house after treatment, and you were a night tech. And I remember hearing that you were French. And I had never met a French person, let alone a French girl. So I made an effort to meet you and to just look at you.
You remember what you asked me the first time?
I had asked you if there were castles in France. And you said, "Yes, there are lots of castles." And I said, "I love castles." We would just get lost in conversation for hours. I just felt like I could talk to you about anything. We didn't date for a very long time.
When we got married, you only had 4 bins of stuff.
When I had started from scratch with nothing, I had this perspective that I would never succeed. Everyone had always said, "You should go back to school. You're so smart." And I never attempted it because I was afraid. And one day, I went to the school where they do GED testing. And I sat down and they said, "Well, what do you need to work on?" And I said, "Everything." And after about 2 weeks of working, I took the practice test. And my tutor said, "You have really good scores. We're going to have you do your official GED test next week." So I took all of my tests, and I just wrote it off as something that I failed. And he called me, and he said, "You passed."
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me some momentum in life to succeed.
What do you see as your biggest accomplishments in life?
My greatest accomplishment is sobriety, because through sobriety I've learned how to conduct my life with gentleness and courage. It's different now. I have so much to live for. Sometimes I watch you at home, and when I see you interact with my children, I feel so happy that I could cry. Being a good parent is something that I cherish, because it's something that I was deprived as a child. So I try to break that cycle and just be good.
And what advice would you have for somebody who's going through the same situation that you went through as a kid?
I would just tell them that I love them.
And I love you.
And I love you.
That was Dustin and Caroline sharing the story of their meeting and life together and Dustin's journey from alcohol addiction to sobriety. It's produced by NPR's StoryCorps team and presented by the Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation as part of their Opportunity Rising initiative. Coming in September on Simply Superior... It's election season, as if you didn't notice, and we'll host a series of debates with Wisconsin State Assembly candidates from our region. Listen for regular updates. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. The show is produced by me, with administrative support from Allison Wade and technical support by John Talcott. Paul Damberg is executive producer. Our theme song was written by Bruce Nelson. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Superior news and issues from a superior point of view. Gathered to mirror your life and interests with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear. By sharing the stories and information, you'll enjoy and want.